You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
But what I need to tell you is, it's all about making that money. And then he turned around and walked.
Happy New Year, everybody, and welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. Every week, we bring you new, in-depth, original conversations with some of the most exciting and important folks in hip-hop. This week, I'm really honored to bring you an interview with one of my all-time favorite artists, Boots Riley, of the Oakland rap group The Coup. The Coup is a long-running group that's been putting out politically engaged, smart, fun records since 1993's Kill My Landlord. He's also part of the group Street Sweeper Social Club with Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello, and he is, for my money, one of the best MCs working today. The Coup's latest album, Sorry to Bother You, is, as you'll hear, the soundtrack to a soon-to-be-released movie of the same name that Boots wrote and starred in. Ladies and gentlemen, Boots Riley. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm Same Old Sean, here with a real pleasure, here with Boots Riley of The Coup, one of my absolute favorite rappers. He knew, because the first thing I saw when I met him was bum rushed him with a cassette copy of his first album. Had it been a while since you'd seen that?
Oh, yeah. I think even when we put out cassettes, they were already telling us cassettes were going out back then, you know. I mean, although that's the only thing that we had, I think we were amazed when we saw one on CD, because they did put that album out on CD, but it was kind of like, oh, are people really going to play this in a CD? Because back then, if you had a CD player, you were really into your audio. You wanted that crystal clear sound. And so you might, if you had a real big system in your car, you might have a CD player. Maybe.
Definitely.
And then if you were one of those hi-fi guys that, you know.
Yeah.
I'm getting rid of all my records and I'm getting them on CD. You know, they had some of those guys.
Right. That's what caused the music industry boom of the 90s, where they were, you know, throwing money at everything that moved. So that first record was like 93, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was re-listening to that record to prepare for this, and it really struck me that kind of the LA riots and there are just sort of a big, I guess, theme. It's not even that you necessarily reference them explicitly so much, but they seem to influence.
Before the LA
really?
Riots, it came the stuff that you're probably referring to, the song "The Coup."
Yeah, The Coup,
which
right?
Came out on our EP first, which came out in 1991, right. Which was before the LA riots.
Wow.
Yeah. So sort of came out in January of 91, or no, April of 91, maybe. Yeah.
That's incredible. So all the stuff on there about riots.
It was just wishful thinking, you know. But in it, it's more, and that's why I say on it, it's or that's why the guy, the reporter, Dick Doolittle, who's actually voiced by my then friend Osagie Foe, who shows up later on Interrogation,
mm-hmm.
he's saying something, and I say it's a rebellion, not a riot. And in it, it talks about a very thought out thing that of people redistributing the wealth, and you know, in the riots that we see, nothing is that organized.
Sure.
Know? Yeah.
Sure, definitely. So. That record, man, the first song on it, Dig It, you came right out the gate, you know, your first song, your first album with, like, really, you know, serious, deep kind of political knowledge, you know, dropping names and concepts and, you know, primitive accumulation, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's probably the only song I did that on and will do that on. You know, it's more of some identity politics sort of thing, like to let it be clear, you know, where in the political realm you could put me.
So it wasn't an accident that that was the lead off track. That was like, this is, we're here. And
it had more to do with the music of why it was the lead off track. But it wasn't the lead off track, actually. Not Yet Free was the first single.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Okay, I think I meant in the album order.
Oh, okay, yeah, in the album where it was just, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the last song recorded.
Wow.
And written, you know, like everything else was written. Matter of fact, when Wild Pitch got to us, we had the whole album done, and we were going to put it out ourselves. Wow. And that was at a time when every label had to have a Bay Area group, preferably an Oakland group.
Wow.
And so, you know.
Yeah. So you've obviously had a long career, and you've seen kind of the ups and downs of rap. That I don't want to say political rap, because, you know, you've often said, and you're right, that all rap is political, but rap that is, let's say, more sort of overtly political or consciously, intentionally political. You've seen sort of the ups and downs of that being in critical favor and popular favor and falling out again. It seems like there's kind of a mini trend of that kind of coming back, in a way, that seems to me to be tied to the Occupy movement. I noticed that, like, you and Lupe and Brother Ali, especially all artists who've been personally involved in the Occupy movement in different cities, have released, within just a couple months of each other, politically engaged albums. And I was wondering maybe if you had noticed that, or what you thought about that, or kind of the relationship between Occupy and hip-hop, or at least some sections of hip-hop.
Yeah, I think it goes just along with my general theory that if you have a movement going on that's dealing with material issues and at least has a chance of changing some things in people's lives, then you'll have culture and art that develops out of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, because that sort of stuff doesn't come out of the blue. People have to grab it from their real lives. And so it makes total sense that that might happen. I think even more so, like, you know, when some of these 12-year-olds who are seeing, like, hundreds of people come help move their furniture into their house, like, against the wishes of the police, and help them keep their home, like, people seeing, like, actual changes happening and them growing up with that, then that movement is going to seep into people's lyrics even more.
Definitely. So you have a movie, right, for which the new album is sort of a soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious about that because one of the things that makes your group stand out as, you know, musically, is that you have these short stories going on over the course of maybe two or three songs with skits in between and sound effects and all that. What does making a movie allow you to do in terms of storytelling that you haven't already done on record?
Allows me to focus on dialogue. With a record, with music, you still are stuck to certain confines, you know, because the music kind of comes first, and, you know, there are only certain things that are going to work. So you do have, and that's part, you know, when you give yourself a handicap, sometimes that's part of what's fun about doing something, and what makes you develop new ways of doing things. I think a movie, it's just a different part of my brain. And you're able to control, by writing a script, you're able to control a whole world and bring people into that world, even when they don't know you're bringing them into that world. You know, if when you're writing a story on a hip-hop track, you're using descriptions that bring people into the world, to that world. And people see, oh, I see what he's doing right there, right? And it's a little bit more conscious that it's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that a movie, you know, you create a reality. And kind of what I've tried to do with the movie is, because of the magical realism and science fiction involved, create a reality and then warp it.
Nice. So the movie is sort of loosely based on your time as a telemarketer?
I would say inspired.
Inspired by?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it has magical realism in it, so it's not really based on it.
Fair enough, fair enough. Speaking of kind of magical realist stuff, the Cassius Green song, you know, mm-hmm. there's obviously about real events, but with kind of a fantastical spin on it with the monsters and things like that. The thing that really grabbed me about that tune was at the end, the narrator's realization of his own complicity in the system that is laid out to him and that he hates and he wants nothing to do with and he tries to run away from. And I was hoping you kind of maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think that sometimes, often when we're at that point of trying to figure out whether we should cross the line of being in the world of and being on the other side, let's say, being on the side that we feel that our group of people that we represent are against. So in this case, he's being offered to be part of the managerial class, which will help the ruling class control the working class.
Yeah.
And but often when you're right there at that point, you've already stepped into that world and you don't know it. And that's for many of us. Cassius Green is the main character in the movie, Sorry to Bother You. And what's the song is really a nightmare that he's having in the movie. But I mean, it doesn't actually happen in the movie, but there's a part that happens. And you don't have to obviously know anything about the movie to understand the concept and the conflict that he's in.
Sure.
At that point.
Nice. Another song on that record I love is the Your Parents' Cocaine. And it's just so much fun, and the video with the puppets and all that kind of stuff. How'd you get hooked up with Annie Flagg? And maybe you can talk a little bit about that song and just sort of the kind of almost child vibe of it.
Well, I've known them for some years, mainly through Tom, when we were doing like some of the acoustic stuff. And I'm actually in their video for Bright Lights of America from a few years ago. And yeah, just some folks that I've known for the last like 9 years and that were always cool. And so I made this song that to me was kind of my version of a Billy Joel song with like some like Andrew WK sort of thing going on in there. I thought that they were, that when I made the chorus, I was just like, Justin would be the perfect person for that.
Nice. Another, you've done a bunch of videos for this record, obviously. Yeah. The puppets one for that, and, you know, the Land of 7 Billion Dances.
Yeah.
The one that I really loved was the Wiz tribute one.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you'd talk maybe a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, first, we did all of the videos on this thing for $2,000 each.
How'd you manage that?
For instance, Land of 7 Billion Dances, that was just one camera. We paid the dancers some money and had one camera, that's basically all that was, you know. There were no experience, just guerrilla shooting. Let's see, the magic clap, that was, we just went that's in a lot next to my house, and we just turned over some cans and made a place to that seemed like a performance spot. And then, you know, like, I'm getting tortured in the rehearsal space that we use a lot. So, you know, it's just all illusion, a camera, and then people, you know, that I know that are just really giving of their time, right? But and so that even costs that with people, and it just takes a lot of planning to make sure that you do it and you get the shot, and you kind of have to, like, live with it. Like, this is what we got. Let's do it right. Your parents' cocaine, that was these folks eat the fish, and they were like, well, we're not really puppeteers, but fuck it. We'll make some shit, you know? And they do all these weird things. They, like, work at they did that all at a community access place, and you know that's what they do all day is make silly videos. So they were like, yeah, hell yeah, we'll do that. And so I mean, I think one big part of it is that the folks that make it have ownership in the production of it. It's not just like they're getting hired by a producer who's doing this. Mm-hmm. They're all like, come. And then for the guillotine, we just did a lot of thrift store stuff. This girl April did some great designing. We actually sent out on Facebook for people to give us their knit sweaters, and she cut them up into the stuff that the Munchkins had she had some other pieces that we use, and yeah, we did that whole thing was like right around on one block, so we didn't have to go very far. Nice. So yeah, so that was the first thing. But so guillotine, the idea kind of just was. I don't know, I was listening to it and thinking about songs that had, like, choruses, and I don't know how I came up with the idea to do something based on The Wiz, but I just thought about everybody involved and how that could be involved with that, and just the idea. What's interesting is that, obviously, The Wiz is based on Wizard of Oz, and Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, was an open advocate of Native American genocide. And, like, he wrote about it openly in newspapers. Like, we need to kill them all. They're a threat. This and that. And so I think some of that goes into how he talks about the people of the land of Oz. Right? You think about, like, and the guy that wrote Wicked kind of comments on this through his storytelling, the actual book. You know, if you read the Wizard of Oz books, you have inanimate objects and animals that are sentient beings. But because they are these animals, even though they're sentient beings and they can talk and they think and they have feelings, and they, but they're still the horse that needs to pull the cart, right? Or they're still the table that you're supposed to eat on, right? Yeah. So, you know, a lot of that has this idea of people staying in their place. And so, you know, that's where this came from, is that, you know, in this case, even though there's divisions among the working class, and some people are taught to fight for, you know, one side against the other, such as the Winged Monkeys, and in this thing, everybody comes together and just goes and gets the wizard.
Against the wizard, yeah.
Who is a capitalist.
Right. That's brings me to one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is, like, throughout your career, I mean, starting basically with you know, Fuck a Perma, maybe even earlier, like, you haven't been afraid to use humor while remaining serious, while remaining on point, but, like, you know, Cars and Shoes or whatever, things like that, that are funny, fun, entertaining songs, you know, are both funny and serious. And so I was hoping maybe you could, like, have you always been interested in comedy? Like, and why do you think that humor so rarely makes it into rap?
You know, it always used to mystify me because the people that I thought of as lyricists, like, let's say Safe, except for like Rakim, but the people that I thought of as lyricists, like Lord Finesse and Big Daddy Kane, like a witty one-liner is something that's has some irony and is humorous, right? And so they have that the whole time, like the punchline.
Right, like that's Finesse's joke. Whole style.
Yeah. And so that was always what I thought of that was humorous, so I didn't think that I was doing anything new. Mm-hmm. It's only after Steal This Album when some people were saying, oh, that's what you do is the humor thing. I was like, really? I didn't. That's just how I talk or think or whatever. So I didn't really think it was like something brand new. It was just, you know, I think that when you're talking about the world and you're trying to show a class analysis and show how the system works, what you're dealing with are conflicts. And one way to point out those conflicts is through the use of irony, and that's what humor is.
Awesome. So, you were talking there about people you listened to earlier, you know, maybe, you know, before you started rapping or as you were starting to rap, you know, Finesse and Kane and those kind of people. I know Ice Cube is really big for you. You know, you sampled him on the first record. You have that line on Long Island Iced Tea that kind of pays tribute to him.
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk about him for a minute.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I really tried my best to sound like Ice Cube early on. Luckily, I wasn't able to do it. And I used to get jealous of other people that, like, Dangerous Dame had a couple songs, and I was like, fuck, he sounded exactly like Ice Cube. I wish I could do that.
Is that why your voice was a little deeper on the first two records than
it was
afterwards?
That was probably more Chuck D.
Okay.
Yeah, that was probably more Chuck D. But it was weird because like after our first album came out, like that thing that I talk about in Sneaking In actually happened, where we snuck in and then we snuck in to the summer jam and we ended up just walking on stage with Ice Cube and he was kind of like, who are they supposed to be here? And then you know, we were kicking it backstage with him. And then ever since then, you know, like we ended up being at a lot of his shows and he would see me and then tell his security, oh, go tell Boots to come back around or whatever. But I would be like really nervous and didn't know what to do with my. So it was uncomfortable for me because, you know, like he'd be back there kicking it and I'd be like, you know, like not able to really speak and just felt like I was just there, like taking up space. So it was like something I didn't want him to feel like I was coming to the show just to hang out with him and, you know, be a cheerleader or whatever. But after sometime right after Genocide and Juice, I remember he had a show with Goody Mob, and I went to this show at the Warfield, and I backstage again. And then he was like about to go somewhere and he said, Boots, come here. I want to talk to you. And he pulled me to the side. He said, your work is very impressive. Very impressive. There's no doubt in that. But what I need to tell you is it's all about making that money. And then he turned around and walked.
You podcast listeners can't see this, but my mouth was literally hanging open there for a good 5 seconds.
And so it was his way. He thought he was giving me some advice.
Right.
And who knows, I might not be worried about my rent right now if I had taken that advice.
Right. That's incredible. I mean, so speaking about the rappers, you've had a ton of collaborations, not just with rappers, but with, you know, Vernon Reid and Jolie Holland and Joe Henry and these kind of people on the new record. Probably more collaborations on this record than like on all your albums before, I would say, kind of.
Well,
put
I would
together.
Say more known collaborations. I mean, like Jolie Holland is mainly like playing guitar and stuff like that. So right. Vernon Reed is playing guitar. I've always had guitar players and, you know, background singers and stuff like
sure.
that.
But yeah, but these, known collaborators, I guess, or name collaborators.
So it's just Jolie is somebody that's a friend that, you know, very good friend, and we've known each other for some years and drank together a lot and talked about a whole bunch of things like collaborations and worked on various things. And it just so happened that she was going to be in town. So she spent like a few days doing that. You know, Killer Mike is a good friend of my cousin who used to be the anchor woman for ABC in Atlanta. So I've been knowing him since, I don't know, it seems like the late 90s. Kool AD Victor from Das Races, he was the drummer in my cousin's band called American Terrorists, or what was it, New Earth Creeps. So they've been coming to my shows since way back then, and it's been something. You know, everything is like some sort of like, or get, the only person I actually reached out to that I didn't know was Joe Henry. And Joe Henry does the background on this song called Wasted Time by Michelle Ndege Ocello on the Bitter album. And there's a time when I really was in a certain place in my life, and I was listening to that album over and over. And one day that I listened to that song, like it had to be hundreds of times. And I thought that it was a woman singing on it because the way the credits are listed, you couldn't tell. It kind of sounded like Nina Simone. And then one day I asked Michelle who that was, and she said Joe Henry. And then years later, I found out he was also on Epitaph. And so I was like, I need that guy on my record. And so that's the only person, you know, and he's basically all he comes up is on My Murder, My Love. He's humming at the end, but it's still the quality of that voice that I wanted on there. You know, so I think it just is that a lot of the people I know have gotten known, you know?
Yeah, that's so funny about the Victor, that you knew him when he was a drummer in a punk band?
Is that yeah.
Thing? Wow.
Yeah. And I think, and him and my cousin, they restarted, I don't know what the name of it is, but they're doing their band again.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask you something about, you know, moving, you know, to Where Clean Draws. I know, obviously, you have four children,
mm-hmm.
and you wrote that song, and it's an incredible song to your daughter, sort of advice while she's growing up, and it's really one of the, you know, best songs of that kind that I can think of. Did she ever hear it, or did she hear it growing up? What did she think about it?
I mean, she heard it right then, like when... You know,
how old was she when you wrote it?
She was just turning 4, and and throughout the years, like there was one time, I think in third grade, she had an assignment of bringing in a song and playing it in class. Bring in a song that seemed like it was written directly to you. And then she was like trying to figure it out. And I was like, what about Wear Clean Draws? She was like, Daddy, that's inappropriate to play in school. So she knows about it. Definitely.
Nice. One of my favorite lines of yours, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask about it, was the in Ghetto Manifesto, the you know, Donald Trump pimps down, hose up line. Because I think there's so much there. And you have this knack for sort of reversing hip hop cliches, right? You have the other line about like love the game or love the player but hate the game and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. But with the pimps down, hose up line, it really is sympathetic, and you've done this other times, to sort of stock hip hop character of like the hoe or the prostitute or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I guess what it's really more getting on is the idea that people are of people taking more sympathy on the person doing the exploiting than the person being exploited. Yeah. And, you know, having that analysis that, hey, they're in the same situation as I am. So that's the person that I should relate to. Right.
Yeah.
But I think that often people relate because of a lack of a movement. When people yearn for freedom, meaning like the freedom from paying bills or, you know, having to deal with life's hardships, and they don't see a movement around that can help with that, they look for that freedom within the system. And what they see when they hear a song talking about how much money they have, they see somebody that's free. Right? And people want that. And, you know, that's presented as a way to not have to deal with that oppression. And so that's what people are yearning for, is to be in a situation that they don't yearn, that they don't feel oppressed, and they aren't oppressed and exploited. I think the difference is with me is that I've seen examples of movements that can deliver that same freedom and are more likely to deliver that, even though people think that it's more like, you know, it's less likely that you're going to have a movement that changes things than it is that you're going to become a millionaire. But the truth is the other way around. It's more likely that you can have a movement to change things and make things easier on yourself than the idea that you're going to become a millionaire. Yeah. Statistically, it's just not going to happen. Somebody is, if there are 30 million people listening to this, there might be one person that's listening to this that might become a millionaire. You can either sit around and hope that lottery ticket is yours, or you can, you know, join something that makes it so that all 30 million people are able to live well.
Yeah. And that's kind of been your project from the beginning, which it goes against the grain of a lot of rap, right? Which since, you know, Rapper's Delight, if not before, has
it's
been
not really just a lot of rap. That's the culture of that we're taught in school, yeah. Right? It's not saying anything. Like, it's not like hip-hop has some other value system than what we're taught all the time in school. So, you know, it's the value system of the United States and of capitalism. And
let me just ask you one more thing, which is about maybe your most popular song, which is Jesus the Pimp, which it's, you know, strange in some ways that it should be your most popular song. It's 8 minutes long.
Fat Cats probably beats that a little bit, but okay. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, did you know when you finished that tune or even while you were working on it that you had something really special?
Yeah, while I was starting it, I was like, if I can finish this, you know, after I wrote the first couple lines, I was like, if I can finish this, it's going to be an epic song. I that was like something that I did because I wasn't able to make a movie and because I didn't have time to write a novel. So, and I tried to use literary devices in it. And, you know, I mean, the storyline, if you sum it up, is kind of a really corny storyline itself. So it's with all stories and movies, it's not really about the actual plot line. It's about how it's told. So, that was a fun and fulfilling song to write. When I think about, you know, and sometimes people ask why I don't do another one like that. But when I think about albums that I make, I don't think about it just in terms of that album. I think about it with people listening to all of my songs at once and there to be a variation. I mean, it's kind of like, and this group is not rap, but like Sigur Rós. I only have to listen to one of their albums to know what all of the, to, you know, like you don't have to have all of their albums on your iPod. You can just have one.
Yeah.
And it's all, because they're all pretty similar.
But all your records, and this is one, you know, all your records have been different.
Yeah. And so I want there to be that variation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending your time with us. I really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks a lot. Right, you guys coming tonight?
Yeah, I'll definitely be there tonight.
All right, cool. Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to our interview with Boots Riley of The Coup. This was a really special show for me. Boots, like I mentioned, is one of my absolute favorite rappers and has been since I first heard him well over a decade ago now. It was a privilege to meet him and talk to him, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Please don't forget, if you enjoy the show, to go visit us on iTunes to subscribe and to give us reviews. The more reviews we get, the more publicity and the better chance to get more high-quality guests like Boots Riley. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. It's produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Your work is very impressive. Very impressive.
Our show's intern is Sunny Kahara. The music is by Psionic. This interview was recorded by Brendan Baker. Join us next week for our talk with Freddie Fox, a.k.a. Bumpy Knuckles, and we'll see you then on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.